Shavorsky, like Offie and Wiesenthal, are interested in explaining the kind of puzzle that if it is true that some form of democratic socialist alternative to capitalism would be in the interests of the vast majority of people, that that capitalism is a system of domination and exploitation that imposes harms on acute harms on part of the population and some harms on the vast majority of people, why is it the case that universally in at least developed capitalist countries there is almost no struggle against capitalism? There's plenty of struggle within capitalism, but virtually no challenge to capitalism. That is, how do you explain the near universal dominance of opportunism and reformism? Offie and Wiesenthal focus on the internal dynamics of associations as part of the answer. What Shavorsky wants to do is provide an account for why it is that class compromise can be such a stable and pervasive form of class formations in capitalism. And he develops this through two kinds of theses, two basic clusters of arguments, which I've called the class compromise thesis and the transition cost thesis. The class compromise thesis states that if workers and capitalists act rationally, that is, if they're not acting in some irrational way, they're acting rationally in pursuit of their economic interests, there are conditions in which they will tend to converge on a class compromise as the form in which class conflict takes place. Now, class compromise should not be viewed as the absence of conflict. It's a particular form that class conflict takes place. In a class compromise, capitalists agree to return part of the fruits of accumulation to workers in the form of productivity-based wage increases. So capitalists' part of the bargain is that the wages of workers will tend to rise in response to increases in productivity. And workers agree to moderate their wage demands to a level that doesn't threaten the rate of profit. So workers agree to act in ways that is consistent with stable accumulation. And capitalists agree that at least some of the fruits of that restraint on the part of workers will come back to workers in the long run in the form of increasing standards of living, that is, wages pegged at least loosely to productivity. Understood in that way, I mean, if that's, I think, Shavorsky's notion of class compromise, it's what I've referred to as a positive class compromise, as opposed to a negative class compromise. A negative class compromise is simply a stalemate. You know, so you have a negative class compromise if the threats from both sides are sufficient to create a balance of power in which there are compromises given on both sides, concessions are made, but it's not in the context of mutual gains, it's a way of preventing mutual losses. That's the class compromise thesis. The transition cost thesis is a claim about why it is in fact irrational for workers to struggle for socialism. It's because the costs of struggle are so high relative to the gains. It's not an argument that socialism isn't in the interests of workers. It's saying even if socialism is in the interests of workers, in a developed capitalist country, the costs of transition from capitalism to socialism are so high that it isn't economically rational, at least for under certain specified conditions, for workers to struggle. That implies taking very seriously the notion that the economic rationality, that is, whether it's in your economic interests to struggle for something, depends upon weighing what the total costs of the struggle would be relative to the possible gains. Now, what Shavorsky is not claiming here is that, I mean, what he is claiming is a fairly narrow claim. So long as the reason for socialism is economic, that is, so long as the motivations for it is to improve the standards of living of people, then it's irrational to struggle for it under these conditions. Now, there could be other reasons why you would struggle for socialism besides that it's going to improve the material conditions of life, your own material conditions of life. You could struggle for socialism because you believe that it will improve the conditions of life of your grandchildren, and you're prepared to bear whatever cost it takes to do that. He's not objecting to, not making the claim that that would be irrational. It's just that for workers today to struggle for socialism under these historic conditions is irrational, if at least a positive class compromise is possible. So we'll just briefly review those two arguments. So first, the class compromise argument. Shavorsky's basic argument about class compromise is based around an account of particular facts about capitalism and the relationship of workers' interests to the capitalist production process and economic dynamics. It involves four claims, or four elements. This is on page 2 of the notes. Workers' present welfare is what the standard of living material conditions of workers in the present are, depends upon two variables: the level of productivity of the economy. All things considered, the more productive the economy, the higher the standard of living of workers. And second, workers' ability to resist exploitation, that is, to capture part of the surplus produced. It depends upon both conditions. High productivity but zero capacity to capture part of the surplus can mean that workers' present welfare is low. Moderate productivity but a very strong capacity to resist exploitation could mean that workers' standards of living could be higher. So it's not the case that the average standard of living of workers depends simply on the productivity of the economy. It depends upon the productivity of the economy and their collective capacity, their ability to resist exploitation. Those are the two ingredients of present welfare. Workers' future welfare, not their present welfare, but their future welfare, also depends upon two processes. First, it depends upon capitalists' present investments out of the surplus they appropriate. How well off workers will be in the future depends upon capitalists' investments in the present. And it depends upon workers' capacity to appropriate future streams of wages from productivity growth. Right? So there are these two conditions for present welfare and two conditions for future welfare. Here, then, is the dilemma. Workers cannot maximize both number 2 on this list and number 3. If workers maximize their ability to resist exploitation now by capturing the parts of the surplus and reducing the surplus available for capitalists, they can't also maximize their future gains under capitalism, which depend upon capitalists' present investments of the surplus that capitalists appropriate. So here's then the problem for class compromise. Let us suppose that workers are not sufficiently powerful that they can easily overthrow capitalism. So they know they're going to be playing the capitalist game for the long term. Maybe not for the indefinite term, but certainly for years they're going to be living in capitalism. If they maximize their ability to resist capital today and minimize capitalist ability to exploit them, then capitalists will have less surplus available for investment, which reduces the rate of growth of productivity in the future and the rate of growth of the economy in the future, which reduces the future potential gains for workers. There is thus a contradiction for workers between present and future material well-being, which under capitalist conditions means a contradiction between their present struggles against capitalists for appropriation and their future well-being. Now, there's always, even if workers owned the means of production and ran everything themselves, there's always a tension between how do you maximize your present income and how do you maximize your future income. That's always true. That's just the puzzle of investment. You know, if you want to have productivity growth and have more in the future, you have to withhold some of your present consumption to invest for the future. That would be true even if workers didn't have to worry about capitalists. The added wrinkle with respect to capitalists is that workers don't control what actually gets done with those investments that capitalists make. If workers owned the means of production, they would be able to make a reasonable trade-off between the present use of the surplus for consumption, for added consumption, and the future use of the surplus for added production. They would directly control both parts of this. But workers don't control investments. And so therefore they face the problem of what are the conditions of struggle which will induce capitalists to invest in ways that are good for workers in the future. And maximizing struggle of the present isn't the best way to do that. This leads to then a kind of typology of militancies, if you will. This is on the bottom of page 2. There's what we could describe as optimal militancy. Optimal militancy is the level of militancy which generates the maximum sustainable positive trajectory of wages over time, assuming the continuation of capitalism. So we're assuming capitalism is going to be around for a long time, and we ask ourselves, what is the level of militancy that workers should engage in now that leads to the highest level of sustainable positive trajectory of wages over time? Again, this is simply under the terms that all we're caring about is material standards of living. Maximal militancy is the maximum achievable level of antagonistic struggle against capital at any given point in time. That's where you try to mobilize as much as possible to get as much as possible right now, and you don't worry about any long-term consequences for capital and thus for investment and productivity. You're just trying to maximize your wages at the moment, short-term maximization through struggle. That's maximal militancy. What could be called the hyper-radicalism thesis, which some left parties and movements have seem to support, is that the optimal militancy is always the maximal militancy. It's always the optimal thing to do is always to be as militant as possible. You should always demand as much as possible and get as much as possible, which basically is equivalent to saying that positive class compromises are always an illusion. It's always a sham. That any compromise with capital is always just shooting yourself in the foot. You know, you're always, you can never trust a capitalist. Any deal that you strike with them will be violated, and that you should always try to get whatever the maximum is you can get. The class compromise thesis says that under certain conditions, optimal militancy is less intense than maximal militancy. That it is better for workers to restrain their militancy and forge a compromise in exchange for either guarantees or at least reasonable confidence that capitalists will reinvest part of the surplus in ways that workers receive at least part of the fruits of that investment in the future. Under such circumstances, this is what Szaborski argues, the optimal strategy for workers is to be moderately militant, sufficiently militant to ensure that capitalists abide to their side of the bargain, but not so militant as to threaten the compromise by squeezing the rate of profit. A profit squeeze driven by workers' excessive wage demands is not in the long-term interests of workers. This is an argument that says a fully rational, coherent working class struggle will restrain wage demands rather than always have maximum wage demands, because a profit squeeze on capital is bad for workers. not bad for workers if your philosophy is eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we may die. It is bad for workers if you believe you're going to be stuck with capitalism in the long run, and if you squeeze profits, you're going to actually undercut investment possibilities, and workers depend upon investment possibilities. Yeah?
I'm just wondering about these conditions, and two things I was wondering about is, is this going to hold if you have an increase in the level of productivity, total or total GDP? Because I can imagine workers' real wages increasing, and I mean historically workers' real wages have increased with, you know, absolute with surplus increasing at the same time.
Right, right. That's the goal is to the ideal goal is to have productivity increases be such that it.
They're not zero-sum games.
What?
They're not trade-offs.
They're not trade-offs.
But the other thing that I was thinking is this has to exist in a closed economy. Because you can't have the possibility of capitalists like in the next production cycle or in the future investing elsewhere.
Well,
or
they
investing
can invest,
in finance or investing they, in unproductive.
Yeah, so they can invest elsewhere so long as they don't only invest elsewhere. The countries in the world that have had the most stable class compromises have been the most open economies, not the most closed economies. You know, Sweden is a country that exports virtually, you know, a huge percentage of its GDP is exported, and it has a very open economy. It's always been at the point where social democracy was the most stable, it was among the world's most open economies, and the class compromise, therefore, it is consistent with the global economy.
Right. If the globe is your total closed is your total economy. I'm just saying that.
No. The Swedish working class lived in Sweden, right? Their capitalists invested globally. Volvo, you know, capitalist corporations were investing globally. They were trading globally. The Swedish workers had no guarantee that their wage restraint would lead to. Well, in fact, they knew it would not lead to exclusive investment of the surplus inside of Sweden. But the class compromise was stable because sufficient investment was domestic so that productivity rises could be shared with increasing standard of living. One of the reasons, I mean, there are three conditions, this is on page 3 of the notes, there are three conditions for a compromise to be extremely stable. These, of course, are variable conditions, so you can have more or less stable compromises. You need a long enough time horizon. People have to worry about the future. If you don't worry about the future, you won't get a class compromise. You have to have at least some level of trust that the restraint of wages that occurs at one point in time will not simply mean lower wages. It will lead to more investment, which will redound to wage increases over time. And you need some level of working class associational power to enforce the deal, as opposed to have the deal be simply at the goodwill of employers. If those three conditions are met, then you get a class compromise. And, you know, in my analysis of this, I drew this I explained this logic by having a graph which was the associational power of workers here and show the relationship between that and the interests of capitalists. And the argument here is that for a class compromise to be stable, it has to in some way or other be good for capitalists. It won't be stable if it's simply bad for capitalists. If a class compromise simply hurts capitalists, then the class compromise won't be stable because as soon as workers might be vulnerable,